This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hello and welcome to this month's Ask an Astronomer. I'm Benjamin Shaw and I'm here with Professor Tim O'Brien. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
So it's a bit weird me sitting on this side of the table this time. Normally, Ask an Astronomer, I'm the one answering the questions.
All right, okay. It's a long time since I've done an Ask an Astronomer.
Yeah, it's a few months for me, but yeah, it's nice to be back. I haven't done anything in a while, so here we are. Our galaxy and others rotate, which presumably stops it collapsing inwards into a massive black hole. This, I believe, has been observed. Do globular clusters have a similar independent rotation to stop their collapse? Has it been observed and measured? And is it consistent with current theories? And that's from Anne Stone. So this is right? I mean, I've done this experiment in the lab where you measure the either approach or recession velocity of hydrogen, and from that you can build up a picture of the rotation of galaxies. So has that been done?
The sun, all the stars and all the gas and all the dust all orbit the centre of the galaxy. It takes quite a while to get around the galaxy. The sun has an orbital period around the galaxy of 220 million years. So, you know, seems like a long time. Actually, if you remember, the sun's about 5 billion years old. So I guess that's getting on for 25 times the sun has been around the galaxy in its lifetime. And at the centre of the galaxy, there is a supermassive black hole. It's about 4 million times the mass of our sun. And yeah, if we weren't orbiting, if we were just plonked stationary, we would, in principle, feel a gravitational pull from the centre and fall in towards it. It's probably worth pointing out that 4 million times the mass of the sun is only a very tiny fraction of the total mass of the galaxy, though. So in terms of the gravitational pull, it's totally dominated by the other stars and gas that are sort of inside our orbit rather than the black hole. But anyway, that is right. We are rotating. There is a black hole in the middle. Globular clusters, these are big, as I'm sure you know, big spherical volumes of stars. So the big balls of stars, they're up to maybe a million stars in a globular cluster. They're maybe a few hundred light years across, something like that, if that gives you a sort of feel for the size of these things. And there's many of them that orbit galaxies. So like our galaxy is like a disk with spiral arms in it, but the globular clusters are sort of outside of that disk and orbiting around the middle in lots of different orientations, so they're inclined at different angles to the disk, so they don't go around in the same plane as most of the stars. If you fit that many stars into that smaller volume, then they are quite interesting things. You can have as many as 10 stars per cubic light year in the centre of a globular cluster. Or a cube, one light year on a side, you might have something like 10 stars within that. And if you think about the solar neighbourhood, the nearest other star is 4 light years away. So there'd be many more stars packed more closely together. And whether there's this sort of link to the black hole in the middle of our Milky Way, these stars in these globular clusters, they do orbit, but the globular cluster as a whole doesn't like rotate like our disk does. The stars are all on their own independent orbits about the middle, many different orbits all inclined at different angles. So it's not like a ball of stuff that's rotating around a single axis. There's many axes that these things rotate around. And there are black holes in the middle of them. What do we know at the moment about these things? I sort of looked up a few recent things. There was an interesting, fairly recent announcement of there potentially being a black hole in the middle of 47 Tuck, which is, I mean, you'll know it as a pulsar astronomer.
Yep, very much so. It's got 20-odd millisecond pulsars in it. The guy that sits next to me in the pulsar office recently demonstrated that there was a potential black hole in the middle of a globular cluster. I can't remember if it was this one. It was one of them.
It might well be this one, because the way that was done was to look at the orbits of these millisecond pulsars, so these very fast-spinning pulsars, and then you can map out their orbits by looking at the properties of the pulses that you see, so you can tell whether they're moving towards or away from you. You can get an idea of what speed they're moving at and what path they're moving on. Those orbits give away the presence of the mass at the centre that they're orbiting around. And there was this implication that there was maybe a few thousand solar mass black hole at the middle of that globular cluster. So there are some there as well. I hope that answers the question.
Yep, very much so. Question two, is it possible to detect neutrinos and gravitational waves from the same event? And that's from Robert H. Jenkins.
The first thing that came to mind when I saw this question was the recent, obviously there's been these recent gravitational wave detections. And the most recent one that attracted a lot of attention was this excitingly named GW170817. So that's one that was observed on the 17th of August 2017. That's where the numbers come from in that name. The reason that was exciting was the first neutron star merger we'd seen, so a collision of two neutron stars. That produced this burst of gravitational waves that was detected by LIGO and Virgo, the gravitational wave detectors. And also, and for the first time, associated with that gravitational wave burst were all these other detections at other parts of across the electromagnetic spectrum. So it was a so-called multi-messenger detection where you get multiple types of information, both electromagnetic waves and gravitational waves. And sure enough, the neutrino people, the people who are interested in detecting neutrinos from space, also looked to see if they could pick up a neutrino burst. You know, subatomic particles, virtually massless particles, very low mass particles, which interact very weakly with matter, so they're very hard to detect. They fly through us. There's billions flying through our brains every second as we're speaking now, mainly coming from the centre of the sun, produced by the nuclear reactions in the centre of the sun. So you need these really exotic detectors to try and detect them. There was a paper you can find on the archive, Search for High Energy Neutrinos from Binary Neutron Star Merger, GW170817, with Antares, Ice Cube and the Pierre Auger Observatory. So it was a fun paper to just have a quick look through. These detectors are brilliant. You know, when you think about telescopes, these are some of the most amazing telescopes. Antares is a neutrino telescope which is underneath in the Mediterranean Sea. So it's underwater, just off Toulon in France. It's a 10 megaton scale neutrino detector. That means they use effectively 10 million tons of water within which they've got these light detectors. And so they're looking for flashes of light, Cherenkov radiation, as these neutrinos fly through the ocean. There's a very small chance they'll interact, but if they do, you get this little flash of light, and they can tell the difference between particles that are moving upwards, so coming from the bottom of the sea, compared to particles coming downwards. And the ones coming downwards are produced by cosmic ray interactions in the atmosphere, produce these neutrinos, and they compare the two. The ones coming upwards have come all the way through the Earth, weakly interacting, and then you get a few interactions in the ocean. So there's Antares, there's the Ice Cube Observatory, which is a gigaton scale detector. Similar idea, a billion tons of ice in this case. So it's at the South Pole, and that looks for a similar thing. And the other one, the Pierre Auger Observatory, which is in Argentina. And it looks for these Cherenkov flashes of light in water in these multiple stations, about 1,600 stations spread over an area of 3,000 square kilometres in Argentina. And that's looking for neutrinos coming from cosmic ray earth showers. And in that case, they look for these flashes from cosmic ray showers that are actually produced near the ground. So if you imagine cosmic rays coming from above, and cosmic rays are like protons and nuclei of other atoms, when they hit the atmosphere, they've got a very high chance of interacting with a molecule in the atmosphere. So the cosmic ray showers that they initiate start at the top of the atmosphere and then come down to the detectors on the ground. If this high-energy neutrino comes in, it's got a very low chance of interacting. And as it goes through the atmosphere, the density of the atmosphere increases towards the ground. So you're much more likely to get a cosmic ray shower initiated by a neutrino starting near the ground. And so they actually look for ones that come sideways. So they come sideways along the ground rather than coming from above. I mean, they're just cool things to... they are cool things to read about. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is they didn't detect neutrinos from that gravitational wave source. So nobody has done yet, but they think they may well do in the future. And if they can, it'll tell us interesting stuff about these neutron star mergers, because it'll tell us how the particles are accelerated in the gravitational wave event, if we can get to see the neutrinos and get to understand, say, their energy range and so on. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I suppose it depends on the nature of the event that produced the gravitational wave as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like you can imagine, if two black holes collide, there might be no electromagnetic output at all, no neutrino output, and we'd only see that signature in gravitational waves.
Yeah, and is that there might not be an electromagnetic counterpart to a black hole merger because everything ends up within the event horizon of the new black hole or something? Is
possibly
that...
I mean, yeah, yeah, I guess it depends on just how rapid the merger actually turns out to be. And if you look at the I mean, that's one of the things we're trying to sort out with pulsar timing arrays by just using effectively an array of pulsars as a massive detector.
Mm.
And if there's some kind of correlated change in all of these pulsars, then we know something's happened.
Mm.
But in those cases, we're trying to detect stochastic background from all over the universe rather than just a discrete
single
event from one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know what you mean about these neutrino detectors. They're amazing. I mean, I love the pictures of Snow Lab where you've got people inside just rowing around in a boat. I'd love to have a go at that. I maybe went into the wrong field. On to question three. This is from John Bodler, who's a man of few words. Gravity, what is it? Where is it? How do you turn it off?
Yes, I like that. I mean, it's a good question. And it's a very good question, of course. Philosophy of physics thing, isn't it, sometimes with these things? I mean, one of the things we do is we observe the effects of something and then we develop a model for that tries to explain these observed effects. And you would go back to someone like Newton and his falling apple and then working out that gravity was some sort of inverse square law force. The strength of the force dropped off as the inverse square of the distance between two masses. Mass is the key thing here. Mass is a property of matter that appears to be the thing that effectively generates gravity, if you like. It's that that has the property of a gravitational force. So if something's got mass, it will exert a gravitational force. The modern interpretation is general relativity, Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is a geometrical model for gravity, which says that we've got space-time and space-time is curved. There's a physicist called John Wheeler that has the classic description which says mass tells space-time how to curve and space-time tells mass how to move. The way I think of it is you think about a landscape, so you think about hills and valleys, and you think about a hill and you put a ball at the top of the hill, or you put yourself at the top of a nice grassy hill in the summer and you roll down the hill. You can envisage a hill as being like a curvature in space-time. The gradient of the hill is what we feel as the gravitational force, so we roll down the hill. In that sort of general relativity model, mass curves space, that produces the valleys in space-time, and you and other masses roll towards the bottom of those valleys. We are pulled towards the bottom of those valleys. That's the force, it's the gradient of that gravitational potential. What is it? That's our understanding. Mass is a whole different other kettle of fish. We're perhaps reliant on our particle physics colleagues to tell us about Higgs bosons and what the origin of mass might be.
We've got a few of those.
We have got them around, in the next building along from here. So maybe we'll drag one in and get them to tell us about that at some point.
So where is gravity then? Is gravity everywhere?
Gravity is everywhere, yeah. Obviously, the farther from a mass you get, the weaker the gravity is. When you think about these valleys in space-time, there's a deep dip in the middle and then the gradient is shallower towards the edges. So you feel a weaker force of gravity. That's the inverse square law Newton came up with. But it does go on through the whole universe. The thing that comes up quite a lot, you hear people talk about zero gravity, and I've come across confusion sometimes where you might imagine that if you go up to the space station, you've gone to a place where there is no gravity. And that's just not true. There is gravity in the space station. When you see these pictures of space astronauts holding a glass of water or pouring a glass of water out, and the water doesn't just fall to the floor of the space station, it looks like there's no gravity. They are only, 400 kilometres or so above the surface of the Earth. The radius of the Earth is 6,000 kilometres. They're skimming the surface of the Earth. They're hardly any farther from the centre of the Earth than we are.
Yeah.
So the force of gravity at the space station is very similar.
I think France is often closer to us than the space station.
That's exactly right. You go, so what's London from here? 300 kilometres or something like that. So it's not much farther than the distance from London to Manchester.
They're still very much in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
I think periodically the International Space Station has to fire its thruster to re-equalise its orbit because it's feeling drag from the atmosphere.
So there is gravity at the space station. It's pretty much the same gravitational force here. Of course, the difference is they're in free fall. So they are orbiting the Earth. They are falling around the Earth. That's just like if, God forbid, you were in a lift and something broke and you just fell down. You would not, you're moving at the same speed of the lift downwards in the gravitational field. So you would be, effectively, you could float within that space. That's free fall. Wouldn't be nice for very long, but that's free fall. That's not zero gravity. So gravity is everywhere. So where is it? Everywhere. How do you turn it off? Well, that would be lovely. We could have our Back to the Future hoverboards or whatever. Nobody's found a way of turning gravity off.
I guess you can counteract it in some ways by, as you say, falling at the same rate as a planet's gravitational field allows. I love the idea as well that you can actually turn gravity on. If you're out in an effectively weightless environment somewhere, that you're on a spaceship, you could rotate that spaceship and effectively feel false gravity. And it's a similar idea to the lift.
Yeah, so you're replicating the effect of gravity in that case. But it's not actually gravity itself you're feeling, of course.
It's just another
force you would get the same effect from, but anti-gravity or zero gravity is not really something that exists as far as we know at the moment anyway.
Tim O'Brien, thanks very much.
Thank you.